the pure subjective form of traditional epistemology always exists only as a form of something objective, never without such objectivity. Without that, it is not even thinkable. The solidity of the epistemological Roman 1, the identity of self-consciousness is visibly modeled after the unreflected experience of the enduring identical object. Even Kant essentially relates it to that experience. He could not have claimed the subjective forms as conditions of objectivity. He had not tacitly granted them an objectivity borrowed from the one to which he opposes the subject. But in the extreme into which subjectivity contracts from the point of that extreme's synthetic unity, what is combined is always only what goes together anyway. Otherwise, synthesis would be nothing but arbitrary classification. True, without a subjectively performed synthesis, such going together is equally inconceivable. Even the subjective, a priori, can be called objectively valid only insofar as it has an objective side. Without that side, the object constituted by the a priori would be a pure tautology for the subject. Finally, due to its being insoluble, given an extraneous to the subject, the object's content, to Kant, the material for cognition is also something objective in the subject. It is accordingly easy to look on the subject as nothing, as was not so far from Hegel's mind, and on the object as absolute. Yet this is another transcendental illusion. A subject is reduced to nothing by a hypostasis, by making a thing of what is not a thing. It is discredited because it cannot meet the naively realistic innermost criterion of existence. The idealist construction of the subject founders on its confusion with something objective has inherently existed, the very thing it is not. By the standard of the existent, the subject is condemned to nothingness. The subject is the more the less it is, and it is the less the more it credits itself with objective being. As an element, however, it is ineradicable. After an elimination of the subjective moment, the object would come diffusely apart, like the fleeting stirrings, an instance of subjective life. The object, though enfeebled, cannot be without a subject either. If the object lacked the moment of subjectivity, its own objectivity would become nonsensical. A flagrant instance is the weakness of Hume's epistemology. It was subjectively directed while believing it might do without a subject. To be judged, then, is the relation between individual and transcendental subject. The individual one is a component of the empirical world, as has since Kant been stated in countless variations. Page 510. But its function, its capacity for experience, which the transcendental subject lacks, for no purely logical construct could have any sort of experience, it is in truth far more constitutive than the function ascribed by idealism to the transcendental subject, which is itself a pre-critical and profoundly hypostasized abstraction from the individual consciousness. Nevertheless, the concept of transcendentality reminds us that thinking, by dint of its imminent moments of universality, transcends its own inalienable individuation. The antithesis of universal and particular two is both necessary and deceptive. Neither one exists without the other, the particular only as defined and thus universal, the universal only as the definition of something particular and thus itself particular. Both of them are and are not. This is one of the strongest motives of non-idealist dialectics. The subject's reflection upon its own formalism is reflection on society and results in a paradox. On the one hand, as the late Durkheim intended, the form-giving constitutive elements have social sources, but on the other hand, as current epistemology can boast, they are objectively valid. In Durkheim's argumentation, they are already presumed in every proposition that demonstrates their contingency. The paradox is likely to be at one with the subject's objective imprisonment in itself, the cognitive function without which there would be neither difference nor unity on the subject's part had emerged from a source. It consists essentially in those form givers as far as there is cognition. It has to be carried out along their lines even where it looks beyond them. They define the concept of cognition, yet they are not absolute. They have come to be like the cognitive function itself, and their disappearance is not beyond the realm of possible. To predicate them as absolute would be absolutize the cognitive function, the subject. To relativize them would be a dogmatic retraction of the cognitive function. Against this, we are told that the argument involves a silly sociologism, that God made society and society made man, followed by God's and man's image. But the priority thesis is absurd only as long as the individual or its earlier biological form is hypostasized. In the history of evolution, a more likely presumption would be the temporal prius, or at least the contemporaneousness of the species, that the human being antedated the species is either a biblical remnant or sheer Platonism. Nature on its lower level teemed with unindividuated organism. If, as more recent biologists claim, humans are actually born so much more ill-equipped than other creatures, it probably was only in association by rudimentary social toil that they would stay alive. The principium individuationis would be secondary to that, a hypothetical kind of biological division of labor. Page 511. That any single human should have emerged first, archetypically, is improbable. By the faith in such an emergence, the principium individuationis, historically fully developed already, is mythically projected backwards or into the firmament of eternal ideas. The species might individuate itself by mutation in order then by individuation to reproduce itself in individuals along lines of biological singularity. Man is a result, not an eidos. The cognition of Hegel and Marx penetrate to the innermost core of the so-called questions of constitution. The ontology of the human being, the model for the construction of the transcendental subject, is oriented toward the evolved individual, as shown linguistically by the ambiguity in the article the, which in German covers both the individual and the member of the species. Thus, nominalism, the opponent of ontology is far ahead of ontology in featuring the primacy of the species of society. Society, to be sure, joins the nominalism in a prompt denial of the species, perhaps because it reminds them of an animal life, a denial which ontology performs by raising the individual to the form of unity and to being itself as opposed to the many. And nominalism, by unreflectingly proclaiming the individual after the model of the human individual as true being. Nominalism denies society in concepts by disparaging it as an abbreviation of the individuals.